Welcome to the Still Navigating podcast, familiar and unusual stories from a new perspective. Every so often, a book comes along that doesn't just challenge the orthodoxy, it overturns it, tears it up, and throws it out of the window. In Nomad Century, science writer Gaia Vince links the two great challenges of our age, climate change and human migration. Her startling hypothesis is that far from there being too many migrants, a massive increase in managed, collaborative migration is unavoidable, the moral duty of the developed world, and strongly in our economic self-interest. The alternative to planned migration is global hunger, conflict, and growing inequality. It's looking like we've lost the battle to keep global warming under 1.5 degrees centigrade. Even if global emissions peak by 2040 and then start to fall, the UK Met Office's central prediction is for an increase of 3 degrees centigrade by 2100. At 1.5 degrees centigrade, parts of the world have become uninhabitable. By 2050, that belt of uninhabitability will cover the majority of the world's most populous regions, including Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The resulting migration of up to 1.5 billion people by 2050 to the habitable areas of the north isn't the problem for Gaia Vince. It's the solution to the human impact of climate change, if it is planned and managed. The economic case for migration is robust. Immigration stimulates economic growth as immigrants start businesses and take jobs natives don't want. This releases more productive capacity, all of which spins the economic flywheel as migrants start consuming goods and services themselves. And migration is focused on the engines of economic growth, cities. The depopulation crisis in the developed world takes two forms: population shrinkage and aging. By 2050, the EU will need 80 million new workers just to maintain current living standards. Across the developed world, fertility rates are well below the replacement rate and trending unstoppably downwards. As Vince says, the obvious solution is to match a demographic deficit with a surplus through collaborative migration. Easily said, but as societies age, attitudes harden. Look at who voted for Brexit, Trump and Erdogan. If you accept the moral, economic and demographic case for managed migration, how do the receiving countries of the habitable north prepare? The vast majority of migrants will be urban dwellers, so new migrant-friendly cities like Pala in Spain outside Madrid need to be built and existing cities need to work better. Tokyo is developing an interesting model called hyper-localization, mixing migrants, industry and green spaces instead of the old central hub and sprawl of suburban spokes. We have a very short period to adapt the way we produce food, Vince believes. Current methods took thousands of years to evolve. We have just decades to adapt to our new hothouse world, as the UN estimates we'll need to produce 80% more food by 2050 to feed as many as 2 billion new city dwellers. This means reducing waste, a massive shift away from meat to different forms of protein, and the adoption of new crops like marine rice, and growing existing ones in new places such as high-rise vertical indoor farms. Huge progress has been made in clean energy generation in the past 20 years, although clean energy storage and transmission is behind the curve, and we'll still be reliant on fossil fuels for several decades. The resource that particularly concerns Vince is water. With water resources scarce and highly politicised already, serious conflict looms, and it will be the greatest driver of migration to the wetter north. 4 billion people already experience some sort of acute water scarcity each year. The more I thought about the message of this book, the more open I am to it, but there are still huge question marks. First of all, are the projections of migration of up to 1.5 billion by 2050 and possibly 3 billion by 2070 valid? or an exaggeration, some kind of deliberate doom-mongering to cajole us into action. With huge efforts going into climate restoration and the lag time around green technologies already deployed and in progress, is change on this scale really needed? Secondly, the shift in attitudes towards migration from how it's currently perceived to where it needs to be is too big a jump. Many of the arguments for the moral case for managed migration put forward by Gaia Vince and her appeal to our sense of a shared global humanity are just not widely enough accepted. Thirdly, we need a new world order comprising new global bodies with teeth to plan, manage and enforce migration policies. Vince proposes a UN migration organisation, potentially with everyone offered a United Nations citizenship alongside their national one. However desirable that is, it's a long way from the capabilities and capacities of most discredited global institutions now. So, in the end, you know, what gives me hope? And some things really do. First, there's an extraordinary body of science and innovation being generated and deployed in a concentrated period focused on a single goal of green transition, something we've surely never seen before in human history. Gaia Vince calls her book Nomad Century because she believes that science and human endeavour can restore the planet's climate and millions of migrants will be able to return home in the next century. Secondly, and perhaps this is the big one, this addresses the biggest challenge of attitudinal change. A generational shift is happening. Take the UK. YouGov polling from January 2024 shows that for every age band from 18 to 59, at least 60% of voters support a range of progressive policies around growth, climate change and migration. And by progressive, I mean Labour, Lib Dems, Greens and SNP. For 18 to 39-year-olds, that rises to over 80% supporting a progressive agenda. There's a conservative majority, that's Conservatives and Reform UK, only among voters over 65. YouGov have an excellent interactive poll mapping voter views on the most important issues facing the country. 62% of Conservative voters put immigration and asylum in their top three priorities. For Labour voters, it's just 16%. So that's Gaia Vince's book. I wanted to dive a bit deeper into two aspects of it. Where in the world is going to benefit from climate change? But first, let's look at some of the possible responses for cities threatened by climate change. Just move. You never forget your first Asian city. Mine was Jakarta, capital of Indonesia in the summer of 1988. The stifling humidity, the chaos of traffic, the sheer mass of humanity occupying every scrap of available land, the stench of the open sewers, yet the vibrancy of a city where everybody seems to be from somewhere else. I was intrigued to hear that the Indonesian government, under President Joko Widodo, a populist known as Jokowi, is moving the capital from Jakarta to a new city, Nusantara, being built on the Indonesian half of the island of Borneo, 2,000 kilometres away. Moving this coastal city of 16 million, it's hard to make sense of the enormity of the task. Governments move capitals, and have done so for hundreds of years. Moving to a purpose-built new capital says something quite profound about a country's history, how a country is governed, and how it sees itself in the future. There are many examples from the 20th century, and you can discern some clear patterns. Overcrowding, regional levelling up, moving from coastal to inland. For example, the relocation of Brazil's capital from Rio de Janeiro to inland Brasilia, the move of Nigeria's from highly congested coastal Lagos to Abuja in the interior, or Pakistan's construction of a new capital, Islamabad, in the 1960s, 1,400 kilometres away from Karachi on its southern Arabian sea coast. Grubby political horse trading led to the establishment of at least two new capitals. If you've seen the brilliant musical Hamilton, you'll know the story behind Washington becoming the US capital. Alexander Hamilton agreed to move the capital from Philadelphia as a trade-off with his arch-rival Thomas Jefferson for allowing the US Department of Treasury to take over and pay state debts. Canberra was the product of a compromise between the claims of Sydney and Melbourne, Australia's two largest cities, to be the capital. And then there's sheer paranoia as a reason to move. The military junta in Myanmar has carved out a new capital-slash-jungle hideout, Naypyidaw, miles from the old capital and opposition stronghold Yangon, used to be known as Rangoon, and closer to rebel groups in border areas. Relocation isn't a new phenomenon either. In 762 AD, in modern-day Iraq, the victorious Abbasid wanted their own capital to rule from, and chose a site close to ancient Babylon for their new city, Baghdad. Constantinople, now Istanbul, was founded in 324 AD on the ruins of the old Greek colonial city of Byzantium. Jakarta to Nusantara, that seems to mark a break with the past. It may be the first climate change-driven move of a major capital cities. Cities sink under their own weight, and with rising sea levels, coastal cities are doubly vulnerable to climate change. Jakarta is sinking by 25 centimetres per year. It's more than 30 foot lower than it was 35 years ago when I first visited. Factor in the urban heat island effect that makes large conurbations up to 2 degrees centigrade warmer than the countryside, chronic overcrowding and the underinvestment in basic infrastructure, and Jakarta is becoming unsustainable, if not uninhabitable, especially for the poorest. But there are widespread doubts on whether the new capital is viable. Inauguration will be in August this year, but it won't be completed until 2045, and the Indonesian government is depending on the private sector to invest 80% of the $35 billion cost. 60% of the country's population live on Java, the economic centre of gravity of the Indonesian archipelago. It's not clear what will motivate millions to move to remote island where they have no roots and limited prospects of employment. The choice of East Kalimantan, that's the Indonesian part of Borneo, is highly controversial from an environmental perspective. This part of Borneo is home to 25 million hectares of primary rainforest, already under intense pressure from palm oil and rubber plantations and open cast coal mining. Then what happens to the people left behind? Only 2 million will move to Nusantara by 2045. With the government so cash-strapped, Jakarta may not get the investment it needs to make life bearable until 2045 and after. Will Indonesia's new capital prove to be a doomed vanity project, or a sustainable answer to climate change for the inhabitants of Jakarta? Officially, there's no such epoch as the Anthropocene. Our current period of geologic time, the Holocene, or Age of Man, began with the end of the last ice age. The growing body of scientific opinion believes that we are at the start of a new period, the Anthropocene. This is the period, probably starting around 1950, when human activity began to have a significant impact on Earth's climate and ecosystems. With climate change potentially rendering much of the densely populated parts of the world uninhabitable, the focus has inevitably been on the losers from global warming. There's been a lot less discussion about the winners. The 45 degrees north line of latitude is halfway between the equator and the North Pole. The region north of this line includes much of Russia, all of Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Scandinavia. This region, Guy Vince believes, will be the 20th century's booming haven. Temperatures in this zone will rise, but only to between 11 and 15 degrees C with a mean of 13, which Vince describes as being the optimum for agriculture and human productivity. Vast areas of what were formerly a frozen wilderness will become habitable and farmable over the next 50 years. There are serious negative consequences for this haven region from global warming, especially the further north you go. Local indigenous people like the Inuit will find their traditional lifestyles based on hunting will disappear. Thawing permafrost will release huge amounts of carbon dioxide and methane. Indigenous species like the polar bear, reliant on sea ice, may become extinct. Nuuk in Greenland, population 19,604, is a rather modest-looking place. The world's most northernmost capital, its tallest building, the Nuuk Centre, is only 8 stories high. But change is accelerating, almost as fast as a plane on the runway of the new international airport. The Greenland ice sheet, the largest after the Antarctic, is retreating, exposing large areas of land suitable for agriculture and mineral extraction. Farmers are growing potatoes and radishes outside. With warmer sea temperatures, tuna and mackerel are being caught, and the cod and halibut are larger, heralding a boom in fishing and fish processing. 90% of Greenland's population are Inuit, but this is beginning to change as well. After native Greenlanders and Danes, who have a common passport, the largest community is now Filipino, migrant workers employed in the fish factories. Their numbers have grown by 300% in 5 years. Thais make up the next largest ethnic group, a copybook case of climate change-driven migration. The main, make that only, industry of Churchill in the northern Manitoba province of Canada is polar bear tourism. Fortunately for the human inhabitants, Churchill is Canada's only deep-sea port on the Hudson Bay. Connected by rail to Winnipeg 900 miles to the south, it will become a major logistics hub benefiting from the opening up of the Northwest Passage to regular shipping from the late 2040s. The Northwest Passage, as it becomes free of sea ice for longer each year, will cut shipping distances from Shanghai to New Jersey by 7,000 kilometres. Canada is one of the good guys, a stable democracy with a tradition of welcoming immigrants. Canadian GDP will be 2.5 times higher as a result of global warming by 2100, the New York Times reports. Per head is the key measure, as the country expects to increase its population from 37 million to 100 million. Managing the risk of increased emissions and loss of biodiversity will be key, as 4.2 million square kilometres of new agricultural land opens up. For Russia, the story is not just of boom towns, but of a boom country, which stands to benefit enormously from climate change. For example, half of Siberia, more than 5 million square kilometres, could become available for farming by 2080, according to Gaia Vince. With much of US, China and India under increasing threat from agricultural degradation, falling yields, desertification, water shortages and extreme heat, the future looks alarmingly Russian. A major geopolitical shift that would dwarf Putin's invasion of Ukraine as a challenge for Western democracies. As the New York Times puts it, Russia's own food security will give it another wedge to drive into global geopolitics, should it wish to use it. Looking at a map, I would estimate that 95% of Russia's landmass is north of 45 degrees, making it by far the largest of the haven countries. As for the US, well, thank God for Alaska, the best $7.2 million the US has ever spent. This was how much it cost to buy it from Russia in 1867. Russia's own challenge is population decline. As a result of an ageing population, low birth rates and emigration, it's falling by more than 1 million per year currently. To capitalize on the potential growth of agriculture, mining and linked processing industries, they need migrant labor. In Russia's Far East, a possible answer has been emerging over the past decade. China. Pulled by economic opportunity and pushed by water shortages and drought, Chinese farmers from the country's northeast are moving. They go first as migrant workers, then as settlers, and then as agribusiness owners. Putin will be long gone, but climate change brings into focus what and who will follow. How can we influence future Russian governments to be more aware of the gift the country has been given and to be willing to share it? This was the Still Navigating podcast. Everything you've heard today and a lot more is on stillnavigating.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.